Welcome to the Gamers Inn. Come on in, pull up a chair next to the fire. It looks like you've had a long journey. I'm your host, Jocelyn, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Ryan. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Jocelyn. I brought options today for our little intro talk. So
I like options. I picked door number two.
Well, that's actually smart, because door number one is, should I buy Hades 2 Early Access? Door number two is life insurance. Just doing a bunch of work on life insurance, and we could probably kill 10, 15 minutes. What do you think?
I picked door number one. Door number one!
Okay, door number one. Yeah, adult conversations.
Yeah, who wants to talk about life insurance?
Not me. I already did it for 15 minutes today. I'm good. Let's talk about Hades 2 Early Access. So I have not bought it yet, but I obviously am tempted to pick it up. For everything I've seen online, a lot of people are saying it is very, very good, because that shouldn't be a surprise. Hades right, was
Hades
a lot of fun.
Was good. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of want to get it in early access. I understand that it'll be in early access till at least probably this time next year, if not maybe more into the summer of 2025. So we got a bit of a way to go until it's done. And I've dabbled with early access where I will play a bit and then like jump out until the next content update and then, you know, go back in, see what's up, maybe skip a couple content updates to kind of let them build up a little bit, like not playing seriously, but definitely playing enough to kind of like check it out as it's being developed. So I know a lot of people might say like, oh, it kind of ruins the game for when it comes out. But like, I don't know if that's the case. This might just be me trying to convince myself to buy it. Maybe it will ruin the experience.
Well, I know I generally avoided like early access and alpha beta for Warcraft, because I found that like I really liked doing like the quest content, like reading the quest text and stuff.
Right.
And so in that case, it really would ruin the experience, because you kind of only get to experience that story once. But for anything other than World of Warcraft, I think probably for like a Horizon Zero Dawn type game, I probably wouldn't do early access either. But like Hades is different.
Yeah.
I guess like,
yeah, it's a repeatable experience. Yeah. You know?
Like it's, story is kind of, or like its structure lends yes. itself a little bit more to that repetitive nature, right? So
yeah,
if you get a bunch of repeats in before the game fully launches, does that ruin the experience? I would say probably not, in my opinion.
That's solid. Yeah, and I think that's a really good way to look at it.
What else do you get with early access? Like, is it there a set time? Does your like whatchamacallit? Does your progress like carry forward? Because that would be another big thing, right? Like, because it's one thing to kind of like to play a game and then hit a wall of like, this isn't ready yet. Like, go back to the beginning, which, you know, I did in Coral Island, for example. And I guess like if you do all that work and you get some progress, especially in a game like Hades and a rogue light, like whatever, then if your progress doesn't carry through, I know you'll have your knowledge at least, but like if your progress doesn't carry through, then like that might make me bounce off of an early access too. So like, have they said anything about like what the expectations are early access to like full launch?
Yeah, they have laid it out on the Steam page, and I think it's fairly detailed in like what's there and what is to be expected. From what I've read online, it sounds like they are definitely looking at this being like, this is a pretty big initial addition to the game. Like,
right.
Content updates coming after this will be sort of smaller than what is being offered. You can't finish the game right now in early access. Like, they will still be adding like additional, I don't know, like equivalent of a biome. So, you know, the game is not complete. And I remember I did get Hades in early access. I think the biggest issue with that one was that it was exclusive to the Epic Game Store, which prompted me to purchase the game again on the Switch. Which is fine. Like, you know, I'm happy to support the developers. And like, that's the other thing too, is like, it'll be interesting to watch this one evolve over time because it is a studio that's done early access before and has done it really well. So, yeah, I honestly didn't anticipate it launching so fast.
Yeah, I think that's another tick in the pro column, right? Is that they have good past early access games. Like, they have a proven track record. I'd be much more willing to give them money. And especially when it's like early access, it's not going to go away. Because that was the big reason that I didn't purchase the Frostpunk Collector's Edition to get early access to Frostpunk 2 is because, like, it was only for a week or something crazy. And I'm like, well, if it's only for a week, like, there is literally nothing guaranteeing that my schedule is going to allow for me to play enough to make this worth it. Like, if it was early access all the way until launch, absolutely sure, I would have bought it right away. But it wasn't. It was 1 week in April. And I was like, fuck that. So the fact that this doesn't sound like it's limited in any way, again, and they have a proven track record of doing early access and doing it well, I would say, like, there's a lot of ticks in the pro column here.
Yeah. So just looking at this, they've, so right now in early access, they have more content, more environments, more foes, more fully voice acted characters than they did for the full version of the original Hades. So, like, that's a good chunk of content.
Well, yeah, that right there is already bigger than the first game. Like, thumbs up. Did you finish the first game?
Look,
if you say no, then I think you should just get early access, because then, like, you may not even finish early access before launch.
Well, can you really even finish Hades? Like, I did not beat Hades, but I did finish one or two runs. Like, so I'm not good enough to get past that. I enjoyed my time with Hades, and I think I beat one or two runs.
Yeah, like, I guess my point is, I don't think you'll run out of content in early access.
No.
So I think that if the fact that it, like, may not have an ending or, you know, is incomplete, probably won't factor into your experience. So you might as well. Is that a douchey thing to say?
No, that's fine. It's very fair to say, because that is that's me. I don't finish games. I find distractions. So, you know, I'm not, I think I'll get my money's worth during early access. And it sounds like it is much further along. Like, they're even saying, like, they anticipate early access to, you know, last as long as through the end of the year. So it is farther along than I think people anticipated. They've been working on it for a while. So yes, it sounds like I will be getting Hades 2 in early access, and we will talk about it on the show at some point in the near future. So there you go. We'll talk about it more than just the hypothetical.
All right. Well, let's talk about Fallout 4 before we get into the TV series. Give everybody a little bit more to listen to in case they're trying to avoid spoiler things. How's Fallout 4 going?
I am still playing it. I can't stop. I probably should stop. I mean, we talked about it last week, and that, you know, are you going to get to the point at which you were when you stopped originally? And, like, I'm at like 20 to 25 hours, and, like, I'm halfway to have played it as much as I did at launch. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
I don't know. If you're liking it, I think you should keep going. I mean, like, and it's kind of interesting, because I just had this conversation with Manny as well about basically how, like, content creation can sometimes, like, ruin your experience with something, because, like, I was talking about how, like, right now the things that I am playing are the things that I've always been playing. Like, I'm playing, you know, Sea of Thieves, I'm playing Dead by Daylight, I'm playing Hearthstone, and it's like, those things aren't good to talk about on Gamers Inn. Like, you guys have heard me talk about them 100 times, like, you're sick of them. And, like, he was specifically talking about how he had been streaming the Horizon series and how he wants to go back and do a full playthrough of Zero Dawn, like, without having to stream it, because just the decisions that you have to make, or, like, trying to interact with the chat room, can make you miss story points or whatever. And, like, so streaming really warps the experience of the game. And it's funny to hear you say, like, you're loving it, but, you know, like, do you want to talk about Fallout for the next, like, 5 weeks? No, but, like, I don't know. I am now firmly in the camp of, like, we will find something to talk about. If you want to play Fallout 4 more and you want to go and finish the game, you play Fallout 4, Ryan. I will carry us. Okay. I will do that for you.
Perfect.
But yeah, it is. It's very interesting when like you're creating content around games, how that can kind of warp your experience of them. And I mean, like, you can go as far back on TGI as to go all the way to the Halo series to see how true that is.
Yeah, we're still recovering from that.
It was like a decade ago.
Yeah, scars. Yeah, scars don't heal, right? I am very much enjoying my time with it. And I think it comes down to the fact of like it. I've gotten through that the open world hump of like, what am I doing here? Where am I supposed to go? Like, I just did a quest where I was back on the main line. We talked about it last week where it's like, you know, your kid's missing, but you're too busy like killing giant cockroaches for Betty Ann from Abernathy Hills or whatever. So, which are repeatable quests. Like Skyrim, it has those repeatable quests that pop up. Right. And I'm like, what am I doing? Find a real quest, Ryan.
Why am I doing this every day?
Yeah. But it's so fun, like going into vats and I have the mysterious stranger or whatever, which is this perk that occasionally when you enter the vat system, like another character will pop up and like instantly kill whatever character you were targeting in vats. So it's just this fun little, it's kind of like an Easter egg, but it is a perk. So it's a fun thing. But anyways, I did a quest where I was back on the main line and I got to the point where I was able to get all like all upset about my kid, like, and yell at people who knew maybe what happened. Like, I'm swearing at this guy who helped kidnap my kid. And it was like, okay, yeah, that's right. 'Cause like for the last 20 hours, I've been roaming around, doing side quests. And my character's pissed off. Like, where's my kid? You know, it's not my fault that we got bullshit in the wasteland to take care of. You've just been sitting here waiting. Like, when's this character going to come here and confront me about that kid I kidnapped? You know, maybe we don't
know. Did you at least, I was going to say, did you at least find out if it was like yesterday or 10 years ago?
No, like I know me as Ryan, like I remember from my first playthrough, I kind of, there's the twist. Ooh, what a twist of, you know, how old your son is, Sean. And I do know that when I did this quest, like the character, like before, you know, he has the, he's like, oh, come on in, we'll talk. And obviously the conversation ends with you, you know, trying to kill each other. But he does have a line where it's like, oh, you know, you might be surprised to know that your boy is a little older than when you last saw him. And it's like, well, yeah, like I know there's some amount of time,
yeah.
You know, but, you know, spoiler alert, he's an old man. Oh. And then it's like, it's constantly throwing like these, distractions. Wait, so then
shouldn't the person that you, if your son's an old man, shouldn't the person who kidnapped him be an older man?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you, wait, what a twist. The guy you confronted was super duper old. And then no. I wonder if my son is still a kid.
So the game deals with a lot of like, they call them synths. They're like robots that look like humans, and they vary. Okay. Some of them look like humans, some of them are more like
robot-y.
Humanoid robots. So it plays a lot with that idea of robots, and after you kill this character, you're like, oh man, he was barely human. I wonder how old he was, and you find like he's got a bunch of cybernetic parts and stuff. Mm. So the game kind of throws you off a lot, and that was the big twist, is like you discover like, your son is an old man and he's the bad guy, you know, like it's like, ugh, it's kind of, you know, the whole driving force of the game just turns out to be your son was raised by bad people and is now like the bad guy. I never finished it though, so like maybe
he's a good bad guy.
Maybe. I think he's just a bad guy, to be honest.
Maybe.
I don't know. I'm too distracted by
cockroaches.
Helping Preston. It's not Preston Gravy. That's not his name. Preston Garvey? I think that's what his name is. Anyways, helping him with the Minuteman.
At least it was close.
It was. Look, I don't know which is right. Maybe someone in the Discord. Well, I could have Googled it. but I prefer.
Nah.
Yeah, who does that? Fun. We're on a show. We're professionals. So yeah, I think the thing that is keeping me coming back is just like I'm in the groove now. I understand what I can and should be doing, and I'm having fun doing it. And I've unlocked a bunch of extra companion characters to bring along on quests. I can sort of sniff out quests that are like, these are repeatable, these are interesting side quests, this is DLC. So I've kind of tried to keep myself going on a path where I'm like inserting myself into the DLC quests that I definitely did not touch when I first played. And they're kind of like spliced along the main path, like at every 15 levels or so. And I know last week I said like my goal is to at least play the first DLC, but now I've kind of shifted towards like, okay, I hear the second DLC, which was Far Harbor, is like really good. Like one of the best DLCs that they put out for Fallout 4. So that is my new goal, is to like do that and kind of experience that. Sean's just going to have to wait a little bit longer. He's probably
already waited like decades. So
yeah, I mean, he lacked a good parental figure, and he just turned into a, like a bad guy who, can't even remember if he's the person who made all the bad robots. I don't know. He'll be fine though. I think the ending. It's kind of funny to transition to the show. The ending of Fallout 4 and maybe Fallout 3 as well is kind of similar to sort of all the factions kind of like coming to a battle at the end, and you kind of have to pick a few sides. Like there's some neutral sides, there's some bad sides, and there's some good sides, and you kind of like that's how I think Fallout 4 ends, is like you kind of have to eventually you have to come to a point where like you have to choose an allegiance or two to conclude the story.
Okay, so that's why everyone was talking about canonical endings. Okay, so we should say from now on, we're going to be talking about the Fallout TV show, or at least I'm going to draw some parallels between the TV show and what Ryan has said about Fallout 4. So if you're looking for no spoilers for the Fallout TV series, go to gamersinpodcast.com and check the show notes in order to see what our timestamps are so you can stay away from potential spoilers. But yeah, so in terms of canonical endings, I did see somebody online somewhere on some social media site, can't remember which one now, basically saying that the TV series gives a canonical ending to, I believe it was Fallout 3.
Okay.
I think. Mm. Or maybe it was Fallout 4. Now I can't remember. Because the TV series is like 200 plus years, right?
Yeah.
So it itself doesn't tell a story that's been told in a Fallout game, but it is in the Fallout universe. And so like timing wise and given the events of the final episode, it makes canonical something that has happened at the end of either Fallout 3 or Fallout 4. Can't remember which one, but it is very, very similar where like a whole bunch of people come together and there's a big battle and yeah.
So, I found an article. So it's basically and I think that this is the thing, like, Joss and I aren't like huge Fallout nerds. There's obviously a lot in this show for, all of the Fallout games. I saw and read connections to Fallout 1 and 2, which are the original sort of tactics focused game, or not tactics, but isometric games. And then you have the Bethesda era with Fallout 3, New Vegas, and 4. And they're like strong connections to New Vegas, which is like sort of the side Obsidian thing. So the canonical ending for Fallout 4 is based on the fact that there is a ship that shows up at the end of the show, which is, they say, is the Pridewin class craft, which is a ship that is present in Fallout 4. And it basically means you either had the Brotherhood canonical ending and they took control of the Commonwealth, or the Minutemen defeated the Institute and remained on good terms with the Brotherhood. So like, you have a couple options there, but I'm guessing that the other canonical endings had something bad happen to the giant ship.
Oh, okay. See, I assumed that the canonical ending was the like turning on of all the lights.
It's interesting. Yeah, because I think like that. So New Vegas deals a lot with the new Californian Republic, from what I was able to understand. And that is like, you know, that is connected to what happened at the end with turning on all the lights and stuff. And I think it goes back to a theme for Fallout in that the line is like, everybody wants to save the world. They just disagree on how to go about doing it. You know, infinite power to power a city and bring back civilization. That seems like a pretty good way to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Although everybody else kind of disagrees with that. And it's very interesting to look at sort of the reaction to the show, because there's a lot that is made canonical that was felt like on purpose was avoided in the video game.
Was ambiguous, yeah.
Yeah, like the vaults and the mystery and what caused the war, like giving canonical answers to that in the show almost feels like, it feels like, you know, they were kind of treating us in a way that was like very generous on the show. Because, you know, I think Lost kind of scarred us, where it's like, let's have a bunch of mysteries and polar bears and like taxi machine sounding cloud monsters and never explain it. And that's part of like, the weekly mystery. But Fallout really kind of lays it all out for you and kind
of explains. Did tie up a lot of ends for sure. And actually, I've never played the Fallout games. We covered that a few times, but I will say, over the course of the series, the thing I cared the least about was all of the Brotherhood stuff.
Right.
And to the point that, like, I was talking to Matt and I was like, is the Brotherhood an actual thing in the game? Like, and he was like, oh yeah, they're there. I was like, oh, okay. So that's why they kind of took, not quite center stage, but I would say like they were a solid B plot. Like they were very intertwined in the main character's story. And like, I really didn't care. I didn't like the actor or his story arc, like the main Brotherhood guy, Maximus.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime they kind of flash back to the larger Brotherhood, which honestly, they didn't spend very much time with the Brotherhood. They spent a lot of time with Maximus in the TV show. And I was like, I don't like you. Like, he was so like betray-y.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so many times in so many ways to so many people, he was just like, oh, we're totes bros. Nope. Never mind.
It is interesting. Like, I think it's the weakest part of the show, but it put up against Lucy and the ghoul. You kind of had no opportunity to sort of break into the top two. Like, they are just so charismatic and have a more dynamic story. And we don't even know everything about the ghoul.
I feel like the ghoul story is like still coming, which is funny considering of the 8 episodes, like 3 of them were dedicated to him.
Yeah. I was worried that the ghoul would kind of turn into like more of an antagonist, but he very much did kind of stick around at the end and become, you know, somewhat of a hero. Like, he obviously has his own motivations for what he's doing, and they're solid. Like, he's looking for his family. But Maximus is, I think the struggle there is his motivations are tied to an organization that is very devout and religious and like by the book, you know, like you are a knight, you do certain things, you don't do certain things, or you're put to death. Like, it is very black and white, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that makes for a less compelling character. And when he's most compelling is when he's struggling to be part of the Brotherhood, and he's experiencing the world outside of being with the Brotherhood.
Outside of looking through that lens.
Yeah. So him in season 2, I think, will be much more interesting. I loved, you know, speaking of the Brotherhood, like, they brought back Thaddeus, and they made, like, that foot. I didn't Look, I didn't see it. We were talking about it. Croft and I were talking about it. And he's like, oh, there's a scene with a foot. And I'm like, is he talking about the foot from episode one? It's like, no. He is certainly not. There is a foot scene twice, and it is just gets worse every time. But him turning into a ghoul, it was just like a priceless reaction of like, ah, shit, I'm a ghoul? Oh, man. This is reaction. He was like, he was upset by it. But he wasn't like distraught.
Yeah.
but yeah, him, I hope he comes back. I really like that actor. And I think him becoming like them leaving on good terms, Maximus and Thaddeus, like I think that's a really cool twist considering they did have some back and forth throughout the season. So yeah, like the show kind of leaves the characters in an interesting sort of predicament and where they go next into season two. It made me really glad that I waited to watch it until they renewed it, because I would have been so grumpy.
I feel like they answered all the questions that they asked in season one, with the exception of the ghoul's final question.
Yes.
But like, you know, in general, I think if it had ended after season one, it would have been satisfying, but I would have been disappointed because I think they did a really good job. But yeah, the only question they really kind of left totally hanging was, you know, like, where's his wife, basically, like, and by extension, his kid, which I did also find really interesting because he asks where his family is when in episode one, when the bombs first fell, he's very obviously with his daughter, right? So it's like they never did give us like that continuity. Like they never fully explained his backstory to say like how he lost his daughter, like how he became a ghoul, like how he survived all that time. Like you basically like you meet him after 200 years and he's you know, missing his face. Like, you know, some shit has gone down, but you don't know what that shit is yet. And that's kind of the question they ask at the end that doesn't get answered. But, you know, they did kind of tie up all the threads with Shady Sands, which was the other settlement, the new California Republic settlement that got nuked. They tied up the threads about like the three interconnected vaults. And you know, Lucy's dad, like all of that stuff got really tied up well. So I mean, like it could have ended after season one, but I'm glad that it got a season two, because they did leave some kind of threads to follow into season two to connect them without making it too cliffhangery. Like I really think they did a good job in season one.
Yeah, I mean, and you get the post, it's not really a post-credit scene, it's like the last scene before the credits, and it's Hank McLean in the he gets in the Brotherhood suit, and he sort of flies off at the end, and his last scene is him, like, arriving at New Vegas, so that's, like, New Vegas where he is, which is
right, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Matt had to tell me, because I was like, that, like, skyline looks important. Like if I had played Fallout, I'd be going like, oh my god, right now. And then he's like, oh, that's New Vegas. I'm like, oh, okay, that's amazing then, because like I know New Vegas is like most people's favorite Fallout. So I think that you know, it's interesting that they tied it into that. I think there's a lot of potential there. I don't know obviously the story of New Vegas, so I don't know how much they're going to like tie into the video game, how much they're going to create their own story like they did in season one, because that's really what I enjoyed, is it was like you didn't have to, you weren't missing out if you didn't play the games. Like, I don't feel like I missed anything. I think it was a good show in and of its own right. Like the fact that it was based on a video game, like I never would have known.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I feel like this season was fairly standalone, even though it takes place within the canon of the video games. But yeah, like introducing New Vegas at the end is very much a wink and a nod to the video game players as like a beloved video game setting, all that. I think it'll play, like, it's going to play a part. There probably will be like scenes and full episodes in New Vegas, but because it takes place probably 15, 20 years after the video game, you can have sort of...
Okay, it is. So it does take place after New Vegas. Okay.
Yeah, like all of this stuff. It's kind of interesting because like the TV show takes place after all the video games.
Okay, I thought it was between 3 and 4.
No, yeah, it's set 9 years after 4. And 4 is, it takes place after New Vegas. They kind of like, you know, fast forward 8 or 9 years every game and then set them in a completely different part of the country. So it really is just like a, you can reference those other places and do it vaguely enough that you don't have to worry about canonical endings. And kind of go from there. That's been my experience with the franchise, but, whatever Fallout 5 is, will have to take into account what happens in this show, especially with the fact that like you have the motivations behind Vault Tech, being sort of unveiled as them like basically taking over the world by causing this nuclear war to happen. And yeah, so like that's a huge
which was reveal. Kind of that scene where was his name Coop, right? Something yes. Cooper, I think, the actor that turns into the ghoul.
Yeah, Cooper, Howard Cooper,
maybe. Anyways, when he's the ghoul, when he's sitting there, like listening to. Like everybody else and the like talk in that big, you know, we're all evil corporations meeting. And he's sitting there like expecting his wife to be like appalled or, you know, blindsided or not involved in it or whatever. Like, you know, and then to hear her say like, no, we're going to drop the bombs. Like it's wild that like, I mean, he's obviously an amazing actor, but like that scene was just. Oh, it was so good. And like, and that scene was like so mind blowing because it's like, that was not only the reveal of like his wife is evil. Also, Vault Tech dropped the bombs. And also it was the reveal of Lucy's dad, right? Yeah. Like it
the
was
de-aging.
It was all, the de-aging of Lucy's dad.
Which was like, we've seen a lot of de-aging and I watched Indiana Jones and the Circle of... No, that's the video game. What is it? The Dial of Destiny. And they had like a 20-minute segment where they had de-aged Harrison Ford. It looked pretty good. But I think in this show, it looked a little it didn't look as good as we've seen previously, but it was like
I think it looked close. Kind of okay because like the scene where it was done, he was kind of reeling anyway. And so they kind of made not just the actor like de-aged, but they kind of like blurred and like warped the environment as well. So it kind of worked with like his, oh my God, my world is imploding perception of the character. Do you know what I mean? Like it wasn't quite right, but that also kind of fit with the scene, right? So it didn't stand out as like, this is bad CGI.
No, I didn't think it was like bad. I the de-aging stuff is...
it always looks weird. There's always some level of weird.
Yeah. I find that if you introduce it after you've seen a character at their current age for so long, like I think that's why it kind of works in like some of the Marvel movies... And Indiana Jones as well is like, it's your first introduction to the character. It's them de-aged. And then it kind of moves to the present again.
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, we saw a lot of like Kyle MacLachlan as at his current age. And then we saw him at his Dune age at the end. And it can be jarring because your brain is like, that's not what that actor looks like now, but it's what he looked like in the 80s when he was when he was in Dune. And it works. Like, I honestly did not anticipate them doing that, but it makes sense in how Vault Tech, like, the fact that the show gets to unveil all this stuff, like, if you're a fan of the video games, like, I know people reacted very positively to the show, but like in the writer's room and when they were concepting the show, it must have been a conversation of like, look, if we're going to reveal this in the show, there is a chance it could backfire and cause issues for our fans, you know?
I do understand that 100% because I know, like, obviously in the show, it was fine. Like, me not being a Fallout player, like, everything that they introduced to me in the show, I feel like there was enough background information given to me that, like, they were big reveals that only relied on the show, and that was great. But as someone who is a Warcraft player and the kind of, like, I guess, pattern that they got into for a while was, like, release an expansion and then tell the story, like, the between expansion story in a book. And that pissed me the fuck off because I was just like, okay, you are now expecting people to go outside of your game to, like, read a novel, which they were, especially there was two or three in a row that were just bad, like, total shit writing. They were terrible. And it's just like, so you're expecting me to consume terrible content in order to tie together the expansions of your games? Like, fuck you, Blizzard. Like, I really, really, really didn't like that as a Warcraft player. So, like, I can see, like, it's going to depend a lot on Fallout 5, right? Are they going to give you all the information from the TV series in the video game franchise proper? In, like, you know, whether it's, like, flashbacks or, you know, like, just are they going to expose players to that information so you don't have to watch the series? Or are they going to rely on people having the knowledge from the series and just, like, jump off there for Fallout 5? So I think, like, there's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And because Fallout 5 isn't out yet, they have the opportunity to do it properly. Because you shouldn't ever have to, in my opinion, you shouldn't ever have to go outside of a game to understand the story and the lore and what's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, if we look at their other games that they've made in the Fallout series, like, you can kind of, you know, see the trajectory of how they'll treat a Fallout 5, and that Fallout 4 doesn't require you to play New Vegas or 3. However, being an open world experience, there are, you know, hints and references to those other games that don't break the immersion or the enjoyment of the product because you haven't played them, but builds upon it. And they might just set Fallout 5 in, like, Florida, and you don't even have to worry about the West Coast, you know, where this was set, right? Sorry, Florida was the first thing that came to mind. I know there are probably other places that people would rather have Fallout 5 set. Someone was saying that they could technically set it in Canada because they annex Canada to the United States. I was looking into that. That's an interesting read. Basically, okay. America just takes over Canada for security reasons.
That's a real fear.
Yeah. It's, I mean, you read that. You read the Fallout Wiki article for the annexation of Canada, and you're like, okay, maybe selling them Alaska wasn't a good idea.
Yeah, I did notice when they were doing the, like, this is where all our vaults are located in the show, that there definitely were vaults all over Canada, right? Like, it was all of North America, so.
Yeah, I love the idea that they kind of explain why there are. So if you play the games and you get a taste of it in the show, in that, like, all the vaults have, like, their own experiment. There's a line from the character from Vault 4 where he's like, well, what was the experiment they were doing on you?
Yeah.
And she's like, what do you mean?
There's no experiment. What are you talking about?
Exactly. And I think that's where they reveal that, like, they had all the corporations come together and basically say, hey, if you play along and let us end the world, we'll give you some vaults where you get to, like, you know, experiment in any way you want. And there's a bunch of references in there from, and you see the companies, like, Robco is a big one, makes a lot of automatons in the Fallout universe. And there's a lot of gun manufacturers there as well. And it's such a rich show that treats the franchise and the source material in such a respectful way and doesn't belittle it in any way. Like, I know there was some concern. I saw some articles popping around where, like, people were concerned that the timelines didn't work specifically with New Vegas. And I think it had something to do with the destruction of Shady Sands, in that it is part of the New Vegas game.
Oh, okay. But
because this takes place after and they nuke it, it doesn't really, like, affect the game. The game is standalone. So I.
Right. Nuking Shady Sands happens long before the TV series, right? Maximus is a kid when that happens.
So maybe that's where they were saying the timelines didn't work out because it was present, but it technically happened in the past in relation to the TV show, but maybe, so if they nuked it, and I think Todd Howard basically said it works. And I think that's fine. The current franchise head saying we're not New Vegas is still canon. You saw the ending. Like, we did not have to end the show with basically a big hey, New Vegas was awesome. And Bethesda and Obsidian are all they're all under the same shitty umbrella. We'll get to that.
we'll talk to that in a minute.
they're all working together in the same boat. So to kind of accuse, and I think that's where the thing is the timeline works. New Vegas is still New Vegas. It's a game that exists. It's part of the canon. The destruction of Shady Sands takes place after the game, whatever. It is destroyed. That sucks. The story behind Shady Sands was really interesting. You know, being a vault that sort of decided to be no, we can live on the surface. We can build a town that is functional. And then Vault Tech's whoa, whoa, whoa. We want to repopulate our way.
Yeah, exactly. When they first find Shady Sands and she's wait a minute, the repopulation of the earth, Reclamation Day happened without us.
Yeah.
I was just man, that has just got to be such a mind fuck for you when you've been raised to think that your entire purpose, you're literally fucking your cousins so that you can repopulate
stuff,
the earth,
as they said in the show.
Yeah. So that you can repopulate the earth eventually, once it's quote unquote safe, once the radiation levels have dropped far enough and generation after generation of you just live in that tiny little underground vault. Oh man.
Yeah. And that was kind of it was also kind of a mindfuck for me as a player of the franchise of the games, and They don't often focus on that. Once you get out of the vault, the vaults are present in the games, and it's more about exploring and learning about what shitty experiment was going on here and exploring that avenue of it. But once you leave the vault, Vault Tech is just kind of like a manufacturer of stuff you pick up. It's sort of like in Borderlands, right, where they have a bunch of gun manufacturers, and it's outside of the name and maybe the type of weapon that would be applied to that manufacturer, it just kind of exists in the background. But the show really focused on what made Vault Tech tick and sort of exploring that. And I think that works really well for a TV show, maybe not as exciting for a video game. So maybe that's why.
Yeah, no.
Them using the medium really well. And, I was also looking at it, wait a minute, they had a city that was nuked. But we're talking big nuke. We're not talking mini nuke. We're talking this thing got cratered. And I guess my brain was wait, did that happen during the war? But no, they're talking about it as if it happened 20 years ago. I think they did a really good job of playing around in the timeline a little bit, not just focusing well, let's do the easy thing and just work forward. They did a very good job balancing that.
My favorite episodes were the ghoul episodes where we got to see what happened before the bombs fell. Those were my favorite episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. Though the very good stuff there with looking at the past, because again, you don't get that as much in the video games. You get some flashbacks. You get more of a focus on the war. There's a whole segment in Fallout 3 where you go into a simulator and get to experience the invasion of Alaska or something.
Yeah, which they did mention in the TV series as well. They mentioned that the battles in Alaska, because I think that's where the ghoul originally fought in those suits, right? That the Brotherhood uses. Yeah. So they do talk about the battle for Alaska in the show as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's those episodes were really interesting, and it kind of it's kind of funny. I watched Oppenheimer I don't know, last year at some point, and they talk about like the communist parties and, you know, going to these meetings and stuff. And you kind of see a bit of that, like within Fallout, where you have that analog of these characters within Hollywood, like going to these meetings that, like, it's not like communist meetings. They're talking about, you know, just trying to determine what's going on in the world with Vault Tech and everything that's going on. It was a very interesting look at sort of what actually made Vault Tech tick, you know, like,
Which, like, actually that brings up a really interesting point. Cause like they never really, we see the scene where, you know, the reveal about Lucy's dad and the reveal about Vault Tech and the dropping of the bombs and everything else. And we see all that in the very last episode. So it'll be interesting to see what they do in season two, because I would say that that's a bit of a like question mark for me. Again, most of my question marks revolve around the character of the ghoul, because like he is now like the, I guess, sole person outside of all of those evil corporations who knows what the plan is. So how, like, I guess what happened between them and then and the bomb drop? Like, obviously we know he had some sort of fall from grace because he was literally doing kids' birthday parties instead of being a movie star, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, like something happened in his personal life and yet the bomb still fell. So like he like wasn't going to be obviously a whistleblower or nobody listened or, you know, like something had to happen. Between that, like, how is he part of this group along with the woman who invented the cold fusion tech? Like, how did they not stop it? Like, what went wrong? That's what I really want to know. Like, how did those bombs end up being dropped still when he was obviously still, you know, like a free man, right? Like I say, he was at a children's birthday party with his daughter. So like,
yeah,
you know, I don't know. I just, oh man, I want to know. Again, the most interesting part of the series to me was the ghoul and his story and his like arc, I guess.
Yeah. And I do, his quest. I do like that they've kind of brought the characters together in a way that they're all connected now, not just through them hating each other. Cause at the start of the season, they were all shooting at each other. But now,
well, yeah, like, they were all fighting over the guy whose head ended up being carried around for most of the season.
Yeah. Which I did not see, like the chip he embedded into himself was like, it was a way of like smuggling it out, I guess. Like,
yes.
But I thought, man, oh, what is this? Is this like some sort of like revival chip or some sort of computer chip? It's like, no, it's like a capsule that has infinite power or whatever, if applied in the right, you know, settings and stuff. But I did not kind of see that coming. But also I love that all the characters kind of come together at the end. And so the ghoul and Lucy and they even call the dog meat, but the dog as well, they're all traveling together and they're on the same mission. I think that's going to lead to some very interesting conversations. And Maximus is also like, he's been knighted and he is doing his own thing, but also still very much wants to get back to Lucy as well. So he'll have motivations to kind of go back to Lucy, but like the Brotherhood are just, they're going to be doing their own thing because they have that power system now. So it'll be really interesting to see, like, you can kind of see the stories diverging again for season two. Because I feel like the Brotherhood's is not going to be interested in chasing after some Vault Tech guy to get answers. Like, they have their own motivations to try to save the world, right? So
if the Brotherhood even continues to exist in its current form, right? Because there was the guy who spared Maximus who was like, if you get me the head, then we'll like start our own Brotherhood or take over the Brotherhood, which I was confused because I was like, isn't he already the head of the Brotherhood? But I guess maybe he was just the head of that part of the Brotherhood. I don't know. But yeah, he was talking to Maximus about, you know, like, we'll make a new Brotherhood and blah, 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 whatever.
True. That's a good point.
Power hungry monologue here.
Yeah. And Maximus is just like, I just want to go live in a vault.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see obviously the focus of season two will the primary thing will be the ghoul and trying to sort out, like, because as he said, like, you know, war, the classic line, war never changes. Like, it may look like chaos, but there's someone pulling the strings, and we know mm-hmm. very much it's Vol-Tec, and whoever it is in New Vegas, because that's where Hank goes. But yeah, it's just, I did not anticipate a show about Fallout to be this good. Because Fallout is not known for their stories, their character. Like, I was having a conversation with, you know, Crofton and I were talking about the show, and it's like, the top five characters for the Fallout franchise are, like, the ghoul, Lucy, Maximus, and the dog from Fallout 4, which is essentially the dog from the Fallout TV series.
Yeah. You know,
it is just like a, it's not the same dog, but it's a transport. Like, it's a translation from the game to the, although I don't know, like, they kind of get into the dogs being trained by the Enclave. So maybe it's a similar thing there. But the big thing we did not see in the show that is huge for the series is there's a tease, is the super mutants. So there's another faction of enemies in the games, the super mutants. They're not present in the show, but we do get a little tease when Linus from Lost is trying to escape the Enclave. You see a hand or whatever on a gurney, so we might see that pop up in the season two. They teased it, so we might get some super mutants in the follow up. We see a Deathclaw skull. We might get like a Deathclaw scene. We got like the bear fighting Titus, but not a lot of creatures. You know, like they kind of.
No, I was surprised.
Back. Yeah.
I mean, again, I don't know what all is in the video game, but like we had the giant roaches.
Yep. Classic.
The gulpers, which were the experiment in Vault 4, right? And then there was, yeah, the radioactive grizzly bear, but like really and truly, I don't know. I thought that there would be, because I feel like we saw all of those in the trailer. And I just kind of assumed there would be more, like they wouldn't show us everything in the trailer, but I guess they did.
Yeah, they did. The creatures they really kind of held off on, like in the games, I mean, playing the game now, like you've got a lot of like, there are more like giant bug characters, like bloat flies, like which are giant like flies. And then you have giant mosquitoes. There are feral dogs, like sort of dog ghouls. And then you do have feral ghouls as well, which they didn't.
There were some in that supermarket.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. They did touch on that. I forgot about that. So yeah, like they had the feral ghouls. But yeah, Deathclaw, like that's a big classic one, but that's like that's an OP monster, you know? Like if it had showed up at any point, it probably would have killed most of our characters. Except for the ghoul. The ghoul appears to be immune and or very smart in dealing with anything that is thrown at him. But yeah, death claws are a big one. Super mutants are the big one that they hint at, but clearly don't involve in this season one. So I think that, and that comes down to like a budget of CGI. Like you have the ghoul running around with a CGI nose being taken off. Like every scene that he's in is a VFX shot.
Yeah.
You know, so like introducing a super mutant, which is basically like the Hulk, but multiples running around, might get expensive. So I can understand holding back. So, but yeah, I loved it. I finished it today and I was just like, oh man, what a great ending. So glad it's renewed and I don't have to complain about it not being renewed. There we go.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the season two renewal news came while season one was already out, which means we probably have, as with many streaming shows, quite a few years before we're going to get season two. But when we do, we will talk about it right here. And if you like what we're doing right here, head on over to patreon.com/thegamersin to support the show. If you like what Ryan and I are doing, again, head on over to patreon.com/thegamersin. That brings us to the news this week. And we have more bad news. We have more layoffs. Microsoft is closing the developer Arkane Austin, who made Redfall, as well as Tango Gameworks, who made Hi-Fi Rush. And it just like, oh my God, like why? Okay. I will say, not that I am siding with Microsoft at all, but Redfall definitely underperformed. It didn't deliver on everything that it was supposed to. It was the floppiest of flops. It was, you know, up there, I would say, with like Cyberpunk in terms of disappointing launches, except for they never had a bounce back like Cyberpunk did with the, you know, patch that changed the entire game. But yeah, Redfall, I mean, like I don't run Microsoft. I don't run Xbox. We had this whole conversation when Microsoft let a whole bunch of devs go previously, is that like, you're fucking Microsoft, like roll them into another team. That being said, of all of the layoffs, this makes maybe the smallest modicum of sense, right? Like Redfall was a flop, but take the devs and give them another project, in my humble opinion. And then like Tango, I'm surprised because like I thought they were doing real well. Like Hi-Fi Rush was one of the four Xbox games that went cross-platform. So yeah. That I find way more surprising.
Yeah. The news kind of, to me, came out of left field. Like, I was not anticipating it. Like, I think, it proves that Microsoft's... So Xbox Studios has gotten so big in its portfolio that they have to have, like, multiple rounds of layoffs. And I honestly thought, because it wasn't, like, the one in January, like, the biggest layoffs.
Yeah, it was 1,900 people.
Yeah, and we don't have a number of affected here. We just know that they've closed studios, and they say there will be layoffs, but the core function here is they're blaming cuts on a reprioritization of titles and resources. So basically closing these studios, they can focus on other franchises, but like really, and we were talking about this pre-show, like what do they have? Like, what else is coming out? Like, we know there are games coming out this year with, you know, Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, and I think there are other ones like Hellblade 2 and whatnot, but it's just odd, like, to see them close these studios when they do need to make games, and these studios are proven to be good. Like, even if you look at Arkane Austin, like Redfall, there's been multiple articles about why that was a failure. You know, a lot of issues there in development, but you know, Arkane Austin is responsible for some really great games. Like, I think they were responsible for Prey, which was highly, you know, it was received very well. So, you know, everyone thinks of Arkane Lion, like with their work with Deathloop and I guess the upcoming Marvel's Blade, like it's just, this feels like the, like, this is specifically Bethesda, but like when you think of Bethesda, you think of Fallout, you think of Elder Scrolls, and like they're unaffected, but there was other studios under Bethesda. So like, I don't know, it's getting tougher and tougher to like look at this industry and look at the games we're playing. And I know, like, what do you do here? I think talking about it and being dissatisfied with the way Microsoft is handling this is a good first step, but you know, boycotting their products or not buying their games, like is going to lead to more layoffs. Like it's a kind of a damn if you do and damn if you don't. You know that like hitting them where it hurts, which is like them making money, is gonna make them think twice. But it'll honestly just probably lead.
I was gonna say, does it make them think twice though? Like that's what I find so frustrating, is that like, if we stop giving them money, we're punishing the devs that are still there. And like, I know how all of this sounds, guys. Like, I know it, I'm just super frustrated because it just feels like if we stop giving them money, they're a corporation. They're going to want to show a profit. So it feels like, you know, and we've talked about this a few times now this year, is like, it feels like they're cutting jobs in order to reward shareholders and pay dividends and show that year over year growth. And like, eventually you're going to run out of staff to cut. But it's like, if they're profits take enough of a dive. I don't know if they're at the point where they will hear stop firing people. I think they'll just hear, oh man, we need to hit 5% growth year over year. I guess we have to fire 10% of our staff. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just, corporate motivations are corporate motivations. And I don't think a boycott is going to change that. I do not know how we change that. I have no answers. But it just like feels like as a consumer right now, I'm between a rock and a hard place because it's not even like in order to continue with my hobby, I would basically only be able to buy Nintendo, which is fine. Nintendo makes great things, but like, it's just one of those things where it's like, you can't even point a finger at one specific company because it feels like every week we cover this, like every week it's somebody else. And I'm not excusing Microsoft at all. I'm just so frustrated. And I, as a consumer, I, as a gamer, I don't know what to do. I do not know what the answer is because it feels like we're just fucked no matter what. Like, there's no good way to get a message across, right? Like, it feels like if I just, you know, like yell into the void, like they're not going to hear me or care. If I, you know, like letter writing campaigns, again, they're not going to care. Voting with my dollars, they're just going to fire more people. Like, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what to do. And I am so upset and frustrated right now.
Yeah. I think as consumers, you're right. Like, you know, using our dollars is probably not going to address this. But and we've talked about this before, but like video game developers unionizing is probably the best way to ensure that massive layoffs like this don't happen without consultation with unions.
So right. Like, but that's not on me as a consumer. Like, that's not an action item I can do. I mean, I can support unions.
Yes.
I could be like, yay, go team. But I mean, like, yeah, it's nothing that I specifically me can do. And it, you know, like, guys, if you have suggestions, please let me know. Like, you know, a way to get the stop firing people message across, then please let me know.
Yeah. But I think when it comes to unionization, like, we can support, as you know, having a platform and also just all gamers have a platform. Like, even looking like a story we're going to talk about later on is like, when a company makes a stupid decision and you have an avenue to kind of like share your concern, whether it's through reviews or just, you know, talking about it on social media, like, this is a PR hit for, you know, Microsoft. Like, it does not make anybody who works in the upper, you know, CEO suite look good. And it's going to be very hard to trust anything that comes out of, you probably shouldn't trust anything that comes out of their mouths. Like, Phil Spencer went from being like this, you know, darling, you know, CEO of Xbox Studios. And like, in a month, he's going to be taking questions on an IGN live show. And you hope to God that IGN is not going to just throw a bunch of softballs at the guy, like, ask the tough questions. But that's a month from now. You know, like, we all have a part to play, and like, basically, you got to talk about these layoffs. It's the same thing that happened with Jeff Keighley last year at the Game Awards. Like, they asking him to do, you know, every award, be like, and remember, layoffs were really bad. Just like, say something, and he didn't say anything. Like, that was the tough part. So, saying something, supporting unionization of video game developers, and as we said, like, that's where you can vote with your dollars by saying, like, hey, this video game has been developed by a unionized studio. I'm going to buy the game to show my support for them. And, you know, like, that's you voting with your dollar. That's not you, like, holding back dollars. That's you actually supporting that studio in a way that that can then go to being a positive thing for, like, them being unionized.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's the solution here, is for the developers to actually have a say in the matter, because really this is just like, they found out via email. That's like a step worse than finding out through the press, you know, and that still happens, you know.
Yeah,
it still happens. Even when you're unionized, you still find out stuff about your job in the press. And I can tell you from experience, it is frustrating, you know, but as a unionized person, you have an avenue to address that, you know, even if, like, if they were unionized, these layoffs wouldn't be a done deal. It would have been a process. And that's where studios like Microsoft don't want that unionization there, because it turns it into a process, it drags it out, and then the bad press is around longer. They're not able to just rip the Band-Aid off, wait 2 weeks for the cycle to reset, and then talk about their shiny new products they're going to be releasing. Like, it's that's where we need to go. But I know it's tough. It's not an easy thing to just say unionize. It's a process. But I still think this year we're going to be seeing major studios unionize, and it's going to be a very positive thing for those developers, and they need it, because honestly, it's just been such a rough year. We're only in May. You know, it's bananas.
Yeah, it is. So I guess we're just going to have to, like you say, vote with our dollars by buying unionized games and maybe review bomb the next stuff that comes out. Because it seems like that's what worked for Helldivers 2. So basically, we didn't even talk about this last week because it wasn't a thing last week. And it's already been like a huge news item that's already resolved. But Helldivers 2... essentially, Sony, who is the publisher of Helldivers 2, so there's basically Helldivers 2 is created by Arrowhead, I think I'm remembering that correctly. Yeah. Okay. So Arrowhead is the the developer, right? And then Sony is the publisher. And Sony came out and said that as of May 6th, so supposedly as of yesterday, that everyone who was playing on Steam was going to have a PSN, a PlayStation Network account, and they were going to have to log in and tie Helldivers 2 to PSN, and the community lost their ever-loving shit and totally review-bombed Helldivers and Helldivers 2. And Arrowhead, the CEO of Arrowhead, basically put out on Twitter, he was like, hey, thanks for all your concern. I've heard you. Talk to Sony. And then literally tweeted out the company's like support page for PSN. And on the actual support page, and I found this really interesting, it said basically that logging into PSN was optional for games that were available on PC. And that was just like, that was on their like PSN login support page. That was the company's public stance. But for some reason, and I can guess the reason, it's because of the popularity of Helldivers 2, they were going to make it mandatory. So basically everybody review bombed Helldivers and Helldivers 2, and I guess probably flooded Sony with comments, and they have now backed off. Sony has said, okay, you know, thank you very much for your feedback, and we've heard you, and PSN will remain optional, which is amazing. I do find it kind of funny that Arrowhead and Sony were surprised by the fans being able to come together and complete an objective, because Helldivers 2, if you guys aren't playing, they often have community goals, and they'll be like, kill 7 billion robots and the community will get it done in a night. Like, sometimes EU will have it done before NA gets home from work. Like, they are, if nothing else, a very cooperative group of people. So I find it very funny that, you know, Arrowhead and Sony were surprised at their ability to organize.
Yeah, or even surprised but that people would be upset by this. Like, it is really cool that we're able to talk about this when it's gosh, I hope all resolved. It sounds like it is all good. But, you know, Sony has 2 feet. They can shoot the other one whenever they're ready. It would not surprise me, but as of right now it's resolved. But like, when this started, my first reaction was, as someone who has a PSN account and has played PC games before where stuff is linked, and I was like, well, it doesn't sound like a big deal. But whenever you make something mandatory, of course, it gets people like, oh, that's not good. But then when they revealed that 177 regions the game would be unplayable in because of this mandatory thing. So like, that's the critical thing where it's like, you make it mandatory, but you're selling it in regions that don't have PSN accounts. Like, they're just not available there. So, like, that's a really stupid move. And then I understand, like, okay, like, as a collective action, as a community, we can come together and say, no, this isn't right, because you're basically taking the game away from these regions that don't have PSN accounts. And what, like, are you going to offer them a refund? And Steam was processing refunds for folks that were in those regions. Even if they had 100 hours or whatever, because they were going to have a game, they were going to be unable to
access. Yeah.
And I think for me, that was that kind of changed it. Like, it gave me the perspective, like, okay, like, it may be simple for me. My Steam account might already be linked with the PSN. You know, I probably from way back when Portal 2 came out, there was that whole thing with Steam and PS3 and led to the whole, it was a weird time. But I understand now, like, okay, yeah, there are regions that don't have PSN accounts. It's a very good thing that they review bombed, and, you know, they were doing reviews. Like, this is one of those instances where, like, the reviews actually made sense. There was a change to the game. You update your review or post a new review of, like, was enjoying the game, but they're making the PSN accounts mandatory, which is going to take away, like, we talk about a letter writing campaign, like, that actually makes sense. And the reviews, it's not even review bombing. It is reviewing the product. You know?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I probably misspoke there, because
they've been calling it review bombing. Like, I don't think it's on you. I think it is. It's just a different.
Well, no, you're right. Like, I don't think it really counts as review bombing when you are giving your honest feedback, right? Like, in general, like, review bombing is generally tied to, I would say, issues outside of the game, or like social issues, like people saying, like, I hate that they made a woman the main character, you know, like, but this is a legitimate, like, change to how the game works, is taking access away from people. Like, I think more worthy, like, not tied to, like, an ism, like, sure, sexism, racism, like, you know, whatever. Like, it's a legitimate complaint, I guess. So using the term review bombing maybe isn't appropriate, but it definitely had the same thing happen. So a whole bunch of people who maybe wouldn't normally have reviewed games actually took the time to go in and say. And I think on Steam, it went from, like, overwhelmingly positive to mixed with, like, most of the recent reviews. So this is a thing you can see on Steam if you're not familiar with the platform, is you can see, like, basically all time reviews, like, what level it is, and usually it's, like, overwhelmingly positive, positive, mixed, negative, and overwhelmingly negative. And so it kind of went down, like, two steps worth, and it shows you not only your all time, but also, like, your recent reviews, like, so what the recent trend is for the game, which went to negative or mostly negative in the span of, like, 24 hours. So, I mean, it did have a very noticeable impact. And I think, like, especially for a game like Helldivers 2, which was wildly popular on launch, continues to be wildly popular. Like, I still hear a lot of people, like, I mean, Matt still plays all the time. I still hear a lot of people talking about it in a very positive light right up until this news. So I think that, like, the visibility of the reviews on the Steam page might have actually, like, impacted people's decision of whether or not to get into Helldivers 2. So I think it was a good idea and a well-executed campaign, which, again, is what Helldivers players do.
Yeah. So
they are all about the well-executed campaigns.
Yeah, I'm glad it was resolved. And I think Sony and, you know, PlayStation hopefully learned a very valuable lesson here, in that if and I think they were saying, like, I was reading online, like, the Ghost of Tsushima PC port, the multiplayer will require a PSN account. And I mean, that's the thing, is if it was required at launch, and I think the story was they were supposed to require it at launch, but because of all the server issues, they made it optional to, like, reduce the amount of steps you had to take to actually play the game. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't know.
That was the story. Yeah.
That's the story. I was like, I don't know if I buy it because honestly,
I don't trust any of them as far as I can throw them anymore. Right. Like literally, if I see so-and-so put out a statement, I'm like, fuck you, liar.
Yeah.
It's like literally my response to all of these companies now.
Unless it's Nintendo.
Yeah.
Which like they are very matter of fact.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So so yeah, on that note, Nintendo did put out a statement over on Twitter. It, basically, again, very short, very to the point, just saying that they do have a showcase, a Nintendo Direct, in coming this June. And they will talk about the Nintendo Switch software lineup for the last half of 2024. But they did very explicitly say there is no mention of the Switch successor that is going to be coming in that presentation, though there will be an announcement about the successor within this fiscal year. And the fiscal for Nintendo goes till the end of March next year, right? They're, yeah. They're an April 1st to March 31st company. So it's the fiscal year, not the calendar year. So they will be telling us something between now and next spring. I do think it'll be near the end of 2024 because I do think that there's a good chance that they potentially launch the console in Q1 of their next fiscal. So, you know, like that would be kind of like an April, maybe May launch, I'm guessing.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think the announcement will be kind of like around Christmas would be my guess.
Yeah, I love that it's a tweet, like just a plain text.
Yeah,
it's a tweet.
Yeah.
More like than 280 characters. Yeah. And it's been seen by 24.4 million people.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it is, and like, it's very un-Nintendo to confirm this far out. Like, even to say, like, there's a Direct in June. Like, you and I both know there's going to be a Direct in June, but you never know until like the week before when they say, hey, everybody, yeah. We're going to have a Direct in June. I think this might be the most advanced notice we've had of a Direct in a while.
Like, I think it's because like the Switch 2 has been rumored and leaked for, sure. I feel like a year now that with, you know, like legitimate leaks of people saying like, this is what's coming. This is what we've been told. This is what we've seen, whatever. Like everyone knows there's a Switch 2 coming. And so I think alongside all of those leaks and all that information that's come out and the fact that, like you say, we were sure that we were going to get a Direct in June, I kind of think Nintendo probably felt that they had to say something because yeah. I mean, like we know the hardware is coming. We know the Direct is coming. There would have been, again, it's managing expectations. I think if they hadn't said anything and then they also hadn't talked about the Switch 2 in June, then it wouldn't matter what else they talked about in June. Everyone would be really pissed off. So now they've come out and said, look, you know, we do have new hardware coming, but we're not ready to talk about it yet. Please enjoy our software lineup. We're going to talk about that in June, but don't expect, you know, anything else from us about hardware until later on this year. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, they really, really had to say something if they weren't going to unveil the Switch 2 in June. So, because just everyone was speculating, like we were speculating, but like people much bigger and with much more reach than us were speculating that we were going to hear about the Switch 2 in June. So I think they had to get out ahead of that.
Yeah, but it's honestly refreshing for Nintendo to just come out and say it because honestly, they could take the Apple approach, which is secrecy beyond all of a doubt. Like, even though there are leaks from, like, you know, case manufacturers and just literally the manufacturing floor of where they put these devices together, it's rare for a company to kind of like Nintendo or Apple to come forward and say, hey, yeah, like this is happening. And so yeah, for Nintendo to say something like this, I think it's nice. We can kind of be like, okay, we could set it aside. We can enjoy the June Direct. The internet won't explode when the Switch 2 isn't included there. I still don't know what they're going to announce for the later half of 2024, but you know, Nintendo
They've
knows how to make games.
Clearly,
yeah, they are very good at queuing stuff up. They've gotten very good at like their, you know, they've made their pipeline work very well. And I know Nintendo will have stuff for the later half of 2024, and it will be likely a surprise, but Yeah, I still think we'll hear about the Switch successor, you know, in the last quarter of this year, as you said, closer to 2025, and they'll probably have a lot of cool games for it too. But I'm also fine with them focusing on the Switch for just a little bit longer. You know, it is what mm-hmm. it is.
That's fair. So if you guys want to join the conversation, if you have any thoughts on anything we've talked about today, including what you're interested in seeing in season 2 of Fallout, or, you know, if you want to tell Ryan that he absolutely needs to keep playing Fallout 4 until he hits the end, then do go and join our Discord at bit.ly/TGI Discord. You can also visit us on the web at gamersinpodcast.com or follow us over on Twitter. You can find me, Jocelyn, at JossPlays. Ryan is at R. Murphy, and don't forget to follow the show at The Gamers Inn. Thanks for staying at The Gamers Inn, and remember, tune in next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.